Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk with a researcher who's hoping his findings will help communities decide whether to stay in flood-prone areas or move to higher ground.
And first, sticking with the flooding theme, Madison area residents are hoping for the best as another round of storms makes its way across the state.
After some areas in western Dane County got more than a foot of rain a week ago, more heavy rain is possible by Wednesday morning. In Madison, several roads on the isthmus remain closed due to flooding, and yesterday, the city added 1,200 homes to its flash flood risk areas.
Meanwhile, parts of southeastern Wisconsin were hit with several inches of rain yesterday and overnight. Today and tomorrow, northeastern and north central Wisconsin are expected to be inundated as well.
And if all that isn't bad enough, severe storms aren't out of the question either.
Jeff Last is the warning coordination meteorologist at the National Weather Service in Green Bay. Jeff, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
So first things first, how much more rain might we see over the next couple of days?
Well, there's a good indication that we're going to have at least 1 to 2 inches across a good part of the state, especially over the northern two-thirds of the state, beginning this afternoon through tomorrow morning. And then the focus will be over the southern half or southern third of Wisconsin tomorrow into tomorrow evening.
So an inch might not sound like a ton of rain in the grander scheme of things, but what impact is this going to have on already kind of a drenched state?
Yeah, that's our area of concern, is it won't take too much more rain to exacerbate the already flooded areas that we've seen across parts of southern Wisconsin. East central Wisconsin had some heavy rain last night. It's not going to take much more to make those conditions worse. And the hard part about this forecast is that we're not exactly sure where the heaviest rains will fall and the actual amount. While a widespread 1 to 2 inches won't be out of the question, some areas may see 3 or 4 inches potentially, but we don't know exactly where that's going to be.
Sure. And Milwaukee, Ozaukee, and Washington counties got a lot of rain yesterday and into this morning, and more than half a foot fell on Port Washington. It shows kind of that differentiation of how much rain is falling. How much trouble are those areas in southeastern Wisconsin in?
Well, again, because the soil now is so saturated, and we, as you mentioned, we saw those heavy rains yesterday across southeastern and parts of east central Wisconsin, we're going to see those low-lying areas flood again with any thunderstorm that produces heavy rain. And so, you know, if flash flood warnings are issued for your area, you know, it's important that people heed those warnings. Don't try to drive through flooded roadways, and make sure they listen to local officials as conditions change.
So why is, this might be the most simple question to ask, but why is Wisconsin getting all of this rain in just the span of a week, maybe a little bit more?
We've had a significant pattern change in the atmosphere. The jet stream, which controls and drives the weather systems that produce the rain here on the ground, has changed quite a bit in the last couple of weeks. And what was a relatively dry pattern, as a matter of fact, a good part of Wisconsin was in a low-end drought just a week or so ago. That pattern's changed, though, and that's allowed a lot of warm, moist air from the south to move into the state. And with an active jet stream, the storm systems that are moving through the atmosphere, we're seeing these areas of showers and thunderstorms every couple of days. And with that moisture, we see a lot of heavy rain.
And you just talked about that certain parts of the state were basically bordering on a drought, specifically kind of in the western part of the state. Obviously, no one wants flooding in their area, but is the rain welcome in certain parts of Wisconsin?
It is. There are parts of the state that have had more reasonable amounts, a half inch to an inch here in the last few days, and that certainly is important to agriculture and keeping those lakes and rivers at a good level. But unfortunately, what we see sometimes when we see a pattern change like we've had in the last week or so, the rain comes in bunches, and it's hard to turn it off once you get stuck in that weather pattern. And we're going to be in this weather pattern for the next couple of days.
We are talking to Jeff Last right now. He is the warning coordination meteorologist at the National Weather Service in Green Bay. He's with us to talk about all of the rain that Wisconsin has been getting over the last week, week and a half, and how that has led to flooding in certain parts of the state. Now, getting back to the western part of the state, which was in sort of a moderate drought, as we were just talking about, sometimes, as we've seen in other states, when we've gone from drought to a lot of water, that has led to other issues, some severe flooding at times, other environmental concerns. Is that something that people in Wisconsin are worried about, or is that not something that we typically need to consider here?
Well, it is something, you know, to be concerned about. The issue is what happens to the soil in a prolonged dry period. It becomes very hard, and the water doesn't permeate down below the surface. So you get the ponding of water or flooding in cases like what we've seen because of that hard soil. It acts almost like concrete mm-hmm. or asphalt. So the water, it doesn't percolate down through the soil like it normally would in a nice, steady, slow type of a rainfall. So, yes, it is certainly a concern when you move from a dry period or even a drought to a wet period like we've seen here in the last week.
So there have been counties throughout certainly the northwestern part of Wisconsin that have had to declare that have been declared federal disaster areas. That was a big topic of conversation on Central Time and on other shows on Wisconsin Public Radio. But what kind of precipitation have we seen up there since all of that rain happened?
Well, you know, that's a good question. In the last 24 hours alone, we've had 2 to 3 inches across parts of northwest Wisconsin, and that certainly is not helping what has been a very wet summer over portions of the northwest part of the state. As you mentioned, parts of west central into northeast Wisconsin have had a drought, so we're able to take that rain a bit better up there, but unfortunately, the heaviest rains seem to be focusing on areas that have seen some pretty good rains here in the last couple of weeks.
How unusual is it that we've had so many heavy rainfall events just throughout Wisconsin?
Well, it happens every few years. We've had summers where we've had flooding. You know, you can go back to the early 1990s, 1993. That summer was a wet summer. Just a few years ago, we had a wet summer, especially over the western part of the state. It goes in cycles. It's not unusual. Thankfully, it doesn't occur every summer, though. But certainly, the frequency has increased a bit here as we've seen some climate change, you know, over the last few decades.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask about that, which is how concerned are you and your colleagues that we could see more of this moving forward?
Well, you know, there's certainly something that we're looking at and that our colleagues in the Climate Prediction Center and other bureaus in NOAA, our parent agency, that are looking at. Certainly the long-term climate change is something we're concerned about, and that can lead to more summers of heavy rain. Now, we certainly can't pin one storm or even a week of storms on climate change, but certainly the trend does indicate more of these heavy rain systems as we move forward.
Now, looking, I guess, more immediate future, are we going to get a break from this rain anytime soon?
Well, it looks like after tonight's event, we will have another threat for heavy rain again across southern portions of the state tomorrow. And then it looks like a bit of a break. But, you know, overall, this pattern is something that we're watching because it's tough to break out of the pattern once you get into it, as we saw earlier in the summer with the heavy rains up in northwest Wisconsin. And then just a few weeks ago with the dry conditions across portions of the state. So we're definitely concerned about it. But in the short term, tonight and tomorrow, we're going to be watching very carefully.
Briefly, before I let you go, what areas are most at risk over the next couple of days?
I would say portions of central and southern Wisconsin where a flash flood watch is in effect through tomorrow, is our number one concern in the short term as we see the storms move through tonight and then again with the next system that moves through tomorrow. So again, if any warnings are issued for severe weather or flash flooding, people should heed those warnings and take appropriate actions.
Jeff, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Jeff Last is the Warning Coordination Meteorologist at the National Weather Service in Green Bay. We talked to him about the potential for flooding in northeastern Wisconsin and other parts of the state.
Right now, a geologist in California is trying to determine what would happen if towns that experienced frequent flooding didn't move to higher ground.
One of those communities he's looking at is the village of Odena on the Bad River Indian Reservation in northwestern Wisconsin. It was hit by a major flood in 1960. In the decades that followed, people moved to higher ground a couple of miles up Highway 2 until virtually the entire town had been relocated.
In 2016, the old site of Odena was flooded again, prompting Governor Walker to declare a state of emergency. But what if the village hadn't moved? How many structures would have been lost?
Coming up in a minute, we'll talk to the geologist who is working on coming up with a damage estimate. He's hoping his findings will help local governments weigh the cost of staying in a flood-prone area versus moving to higher ground, an issue that seems very relevant as parts of Wisconsin deal with significant flooding this summer.
First, we get a firsthand account of that 1960 flood. Star Ames is a resident of Odena and was a young girl at the time. She's a member of the Bad River Tribe, and her dad, Donald, was the tribal chairman. Star, welcome to Central Time.
Hi.
So, Star, tell us first, how old were you in 1960 when that flood occurred?
In 1960, I was 8 years old.
And so that has to be something that really burned itself into your memory. What was the flood like?
Well, we didn't live in the village. We lived on our allotted land some distance away from the village, and we were watching the water come up. We lived next to the Bear Trap River, and we were watching the river come up, and we thought that was pretty interesting because we've seen it come up before, but this time it was exceeding the limits that we thought it was going to reach. Then my dad, whose name was Don, was the chairman, and people started appealing to him for help. And he went around to the outlying tribal members to find out which ones needed to be evacuated and who needed food or medical supplies.
And go ahead.
I remember that, and I remember a lot of food being cooked in our kitchen.
And so your dad wanted to prevent that from happening again. So what was it like for the community and individuals in the community to decide to start moving to higher ground?
Okay, my dad, there's no way he could have prevented the flood, and people did not decide to move to higher ground.
How did that happen?
They had to evacuate their houses because their houses were filling with water.
But then rebuilding happened on higher ground, correct?
Eventually.
And what, you still live in the area, in the community. What has that been like, being removed from an area that was that had a long history for your community and for your people?
Okay, it seems like you think that the flood happened and then everybody left the area, but that's not how it happened. Our houses flooded every year, and we didn't just move. This is a reservation, and there's not a lot of places where you can build here, and people don't have the finances to just build a new house or just move, and culturally, that's not really in our nature. We're very tied to this area, but what did happen was the houses, we just shoveled out the muck and cleaned our houses, and life went on year after year. And when money became available in the 1960s for low-income housing projects, instead of letting them build in the village where most of the people lived, my dad asked them to build on higher ground. Mm. And so slowly we had low-income rental units available on the area that we called our company farm. Mm. And as our tribe received federal funding for low-income houses, they had some self-help houses built where the community members and the potential residents of the houses actually built the houses themselves, and then they had to pay for the mortgages. And those were built on higher ground.
Well, and Star, so, I want to make sure we find out why Odana was in such danger for flooding. So we'll thank you for joining us and talk to Nicholas Pinter. Star Ames was just with us. She's a resident of Odana, and she experienced the 1960 flood as a young girl. She's a member of the Bad River Tribe. And now we welcome Nicholas Pinter. He's a geology professor at the University of California, Davis, the associate director of the UC Davis Center for Watershed Sciences, and he studies floods and what's known as managed retreat, or the relocation of communities from flood-prone areas. Nicholas, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
So let's talk about Odana, since we just heard from Star Ames about her experiences as a young girl living there during that that catastrophic 1960 flood. How did you first learn about Odana to study it?
So we've been looking at managed retreat, in particular the relocation of communities, for a number of years. And we found one line in a 1958 paper that referred to the relocation of Odana. Eventually dug up a Corps of Engineers feasibility study that found moving it was not feasible. Next thing we do is go to the satellite imagery, and it's basically no longer there. It's been moved from the floodplain to high ground. And so we were really, really curious, and eventually this year went into the community, connected with Star and some of the other residents and members of the tribe.
And what was it about the geography and geology of the Odana area, the old site of Odana, that made it so prone to these floods?
Well, it's right on the banks of the Bad River. An analysis of the history of Odana shows that it flooded repeatedly. Excuse me. 1873, 1896, 1926, 41, 46, and then on up to the present, you know, 2016 and 18 as well. So it's in a very unfortunate location. And so we heard from Star, there was some question about the intent of the move, but the result is that a town that once occupied reportedly many thousands of people, over 1,200 in the 1950s, there's one resident still occupied down there.
So you study, I mean, Odana is, I'm guessing, quite a perfect case study for you, because you look at places that are prone to flooding, who do make that very significant decision to move the community. And you can now compare the old site of Odana with the current site and what's happening. So what are you learning from looking at that data?
So Odana is one of 15 to 20 wholesale community relocations across the U.S., you know, spanning 150 years of history now. Each of them really interesting studies. And so, yeah, it's part of the puzzle. What's particularly interesting about Odana is that it is a Native American community, and some of the attitudes, some of the narratives coming out of Odana are very distinct, different from some of the other non-Native communities that have moved, and are very relevant because some of the headline communities that are right now either moving or in the process of looking to move, Ile de Jean Charles in Louisiana, Kivalina, Nutok, and other communities in Alaska, they are themselves Native American, Native Alaskan communities.
And you were quoted in an NPR story as saying Native American communities are disproportionately affected by climate change-related flooding. Why is that? Why are those communities more at risk?
And there's a broad pattern of social justice issues. Typically, poor minority disadvantaged communities living on the low ground, and that's along floodplains, on floodplains, or along the coasts as well.
How big an issue is repeated flooding for communities across the United States?
So given climate change and other things making flooding demonstrably worse along many rivers and coastlines, it's a huge issue. So you're not going to be able to relocate every city, but this what we're looking at is these community relocations have been utilized in the past. They're being proposed right now. And when these things are being done, a lot of money is being invested in them. So Ile de Jean Charles in Louisiana, it's $50 to $100 million. People are talking right now. Grundy, Virginia, they estimate between $200 and $300 million has been invested in relocating that town. Martin, Kentucky, just got a $90 million appropriation just this year. So this is a solution that people are beginning to look at and probably will do so more in the future.
Well, Nicholas, we'll definitely want to follow up with you as you're able to compile data on the ODANA sites and find out what you're learning.
Anytime.
Thanks so much for joining us. Nicholas Pinter is a geology professor at the University of California, Davis, and the associate director of the UC Davis Center for Watershed Sciences. We talked with him about his research into towns that have experienced repeated major flooding events and have relocated as a result. Earlier, we talked with Star Ames. She's a resident of the Ashland County community of ODANA, about her memories of the 1960 flood that ultimately forced the town to move. She's a member of the Bad River Band, and her father was the tribal chairman at the time. Wisconsin's public schools are starting up classes next week, and for many students, laptops, iPads, and smart boards are going to be part of the experience. All that technology lets us access information and connections in ways we couldn't before, but some are concerned about what we might be losing in the process.
Our next guest says that the push for personalized digital education is leaving out a lot of what makes learning effective. He says that some of the best learning happens when kids are using all of their senses and doing things with the people and physical world around them.
Nicholas Tampio is an associate professor of political science at Fordham University and the author of the book Common Core, National Education Standards and the Threat to Democracy. Nicholas, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Judith. Glad to be here.
First of all, can you talk about what we mean when we say screen learning?
So if you go to Google Images and you type in computer-based education or competency-based education, you'll see rows of children sitting at computers, often with headsets, looking at bright images, clicking and dragging and typing. And under this model, teachers will be on the side and they'll sort of help kids log in, log off, deal with technical difficulties. But for much of the school day, kids will be looking at screens and doing their education. And all sorts of people are describing this as sort of a cure-all for education. And I wrote my piece in Eon to sort of raise a red flag and say, listen, everybody knows that computers have certain powers and help kids find information. But when you make it the basis of an education, that's bad.
So we'll get into what neuroscience and even philosophy has to say about this, but from your perspective, what do you think screens aren't providing kids in the learning experience?
Well, if you ask me what I remember of school, I'll tell you performing in a school play, being a school patrol, running cross country, participating in the debate team. These are all activities that were special, were extra, that were not, not learning to read, write, do arithmetic, do computer type stuff. And part of the reason that I care about this is I'm looking for my own children, and I just see the special parts of education being more and more marginalized. And the fact is that education should inspire children. A good education will inspire children to keep learning on their own. And I am just really nervous about when you have kids staring at a computer all day. I mean, the word that comes to mind is monkey brain, that they just, click and dash and they can't follow a sustained argument and they don't care about what they're learning because it's all so abstract and they're not making friendships in the same way when you're playing and wrestling and talking with other people, and they're not making connections with their teachers. So part of what I really want to argue is that these things are important. Human beings, we have bodies, and a good education will engage the body.
Well, and it seems like this issue really came into focus for you when you took a family trip to a farm. Tell us about that experience and what you saw your kids doing that really kind of brought this home to you.
So I go to a farmer's market, and one day the farmer, I don't know what vibe I was giving off, but she said, let me introduce you. We have a farm stay where we have a RV on our farm, and we welcome people to stay up, and they pay, you know, pretty reasonable rates. And the whole purpose is to learn about farm life, to learn where the food comes from and what it means to be a farmer. And I have young children, and even though we live in the suburbs of New York City, my kids are at heart. They love to be outside and love to be in nature. So I said, okay, this sounds like a wonderful opportunity. And it was just, on one level, it was, from one angle, it was a very simple trip. We were learning, you know, seeing how eggs were collected, or where pigs live, or how cows are fed and are watered, and how the manure is cleaned up. So from one angle, it could be a very mundane experience. But just as a parent, I just said, holy cow, my kids, I can see their synapses firing. I could just see them full of joy and happiness. And, you know, one of the great moments that actually didn't make it into the Eon essay, but, you know, in an earlier draft, was I would watch my kids drop a leaf at the beginning of a stream, and they would run along the stream as the leaf was making its way down. And I said, you know what? I can't tell you what difference this is going to make for them as an adult, right? I don't think as adults they're going to be chasing leaves down a stream. But the fact is that they are learning about how things in nature work, how things move, how water works. They were cooperating. They were laughing. And I said, you know what, this is a really good image of the kind of education that I want to defend.
Well, and it was really interesting as I was reading your piece, because, you know, you talked about, it's not just, you know, you're on the farm and you're seeing things, but they were carrying things. So they were using their muscles, and they were learning to tell the different sounds between the pigs and the sheep and how they were reacting when they came in. So they were hearing things, and obviously they were smelling things, but they were tasting those fresh eggs. And one of the things that really struck me is you talked about watching them interact with the farmer, too, as the farmer was explaining things to them. And that eye contact, face-to-face communication is something that you say is really missing in that screen learning.
Absolutely. So when you think about computer-based education, children are watching a screen, and, you know, they're not learning nothing. They are learning something. But one of my friends who studies international relations, he's a professor at William & Mary, Marcus Holmes, and he does the neuroscience of diplomats. And what he discovered is that there's a good scientific basis for why diplomats insist on meeting face-to-face. And the fact is you can get a much deeper level of trust when you're meeting face-to-face. And so one thing is that if you're on a screen with somebody, talking to them on a screen, you don't know who's in the background of that image, right? You can see their face, but you can't see if their hands are moving or fidgeting. You can't see if their feet are kicking. You can't see if somebody else is right around the corner making funny faces. So you never fully trust the experience as much as when you're face-to-face and you can see the whole environment. You can sort of feel the mood in the air. And you know, my friend Marcus Holmes actually did investigation on mirror neurons, and there's a good scientific basis for the fact is that when we can see each other, we can pick up microfacial movements that give us a much more precise estimate of what the other person is thinking than even the most high-resolution screen. So for me, the farmer and the farm experience illustrated the point that being physically present, looking people in the eye, provides a much richer experience than doing anything analogous on computers.
We're talking with Nicholas Tampio right now. He's an associate professor of political science at Fordham University. And we're talking about what we might be losing with the move to more and more digital learning and screen learning. And Nicholas, you also looked at philosophy to partly explain why screen learning is being adopted so widely. Tell us, in non-philosopher terms, how Western philosophy has looked at mind and body and learning.
So when you talk about these on-screen learning, virtual reality or the most high-tech games, Fortnite or various ways people communicate nowadays, you think, all right, nobody in the history of philosophy could have ever anticipated this. But there's this French philosopher whom I like named Maurice Merleau-Ponty, and he wrote this book, The Phenomenology of Perception, that is a classic, and it deserves to be a classic. And his basic insight is that philosophers have not taken sufficient account of how the body influences how we learn, that Western philosophy, going back to Plato, really privileges the eye, and they really think of the mind as something separate from the rest of the world. So the mind looks through the eye and acquires information, and then it goes into the brain, and then the mind, processes the information. And Maurice Merleau-Ponty, he says, actually, the way that you learn is by moving your body. And that's really a brilliant way to think about it, right? When you're running down a hill, you're not thinking, oh, I'm going to put my foot there because that'll bear my weight, and I'll put my foot there, and then I'll put my foot. No, you don't do that. You're running down a hill, and you're just trying to survive, and you have to trust your body. And I think Merleau-Ponty's insight applies to most human actions, right? When you're communicating with a friend, you're not writing a script in your head and then saying the words. Your body is spontaneously creating these words and thoughts and patterns, and every now and then your conscious brain can modulate or maybe even stop one of those sentences, but really it's our body is speaking for us. And when you take Merleau-Ponty's ideas seriously, which I do, it means that education should really be about training your entire body, that it can't just be about reading or looking at screens or looking at the world from a distance. You actually have to touch the world to learn.
So Merleau-Ponty has been advocating this kind of whole body experiential learning, but are his ideas the ones that have been picked up by educators in the United States?
Oh, not at all. Not at all. So one argument that I did not make, I intentionally did not make it, I did not try to say that the people pushing screens are trying to make money. And because the fact is that certain parents will say, well, it doesn't matter if they're trying to make money. If they're selling a good product, they deserve to make money. So I did not make that argument. And so I tried to consider their best argument and say, listen, there's a tradition in Western philosophy that privileges the eye and eyesight. And so people who are advocating technology and screens are part of a long tradition. And the fact, you do learn things from screens. But I wanted to say that we're doing a real disservice to children when we have them play with blocks on computers rather than physical blocks. And, you know, some listeners might think, oh, my gosh, Professor Tampio is joking. Look at some of the kindergarten apps, and you'll see what kind of things could be on the horizon.
We're talking with Nicholas Tampio right now. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at Fordham University, and his recent essay for Eon Magazine is called Look Up From Your Screen. We're talking about how digital learning compares with interacting with the world and other people.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with Nicholas that learning is at its best when we're using all of our senses in our full bodies? If you're an educator, has digital learning helped you in the classroom, or do you try to wrap those real-world experiences into your lessons? And if you're a student right now, what kind of learning works best for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Right now, we're picking up our chat with Nicholas Tampio, Associate Professor of Political Science at Fordham University. He is here to say that we need to get students learning with all of their senses and not rely so much on screens in the classroom.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think digital learning is a positive thing for education, or are we losing something when students aren't physically engaged with the world around them? If you're a teacher, what are your thoughts about screen learning? And if you're a student, do you think you learn better when you use more than just your eyes and a screen? Call 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email at ideas@wpr.org. And Nicholas, you also looked to neuroscience to show why simply interacting with other human beings is important to engage the mind and really learn things deeply. What did you find there that support your perspective?
So there's been a revolution in neuroscience with the discovery of mirror neurons. And so the old model of the brain is that your eyes see something, the information goes into your brain, you form a thought and a reaction, and then you act. And but the new neuroscience of mirror neurons says that actually when they can map the brain and map the mental brain energy, and when somebody smiles at you, your muscles start to move in a smile before you're even aware of it. So it's there's not a pause between seeing and responding, that as a being in the world, you're constantly sort of making adjustments to other people, right? So when a waiter or a waitress smiles, you feel good, right? You like the restaurant, you're having a good time, and it makes a difference. And so there have been all sorts of experiments that have been shown about how mirror neurons work. And for me, that's a really fascinating idea to think about how important it is to actually be physically present with other people. That there's this education scholar named Diane Ravitch, and she said that part of the education reform movement is this dream of that one teacher, according to Ravitch, citing a reformer, working by themselves in a barn in Kansas, educating hundreds of people. And, you know, there's an appeal to that, economies of scale, about quality control, about preventing bad teachers from getting too much power, right? Those are all there are certain good arguments for that kind of model of education. And yet I wanted to say, listen, we are not going to give children the best education if we are not giving them opportunities to make connections with other human beings. And actually, you have to be physically present. You cannot make the same level of friendship via screens.
Let's go to the phones, and Susie in New London is up. Hi, Susie.
Good afternoon. I completely agree with the author. I'm a teacher of 30 years of experience at multiple levels, and I have used technology in the classroom. I'm always excited about a new tool that can enhance something so that I can do it better and be more effective. But I think the place where our students are falling down the fastest is in interpersonal skills, and it's being enhanced by the use of too much technology. And I think it's reflected in society at large today. And I think the movement away from the teacher-centered classroom is enhancing that problem.
Thanks for that call, Susie. And so, Nicholas, it sounds like Susie is very welcoming of new tools, but they have to be tools to enhance the real way of learning.
Yeah, well, I come at this topic as a political scientist, and so I draw upon philosophy and neuroscience. But my concern as a political scientist, and I agree with Susie, that what kind of society are you going to create if kids grow up looking by themselves, not knowing how to talk to people who are different? And you're not going to build social capital. You're not going to build trust. You're not going to build the ability to communicate. It will lead to atomism, individualism, incredible loneliness, and the demise of democracy. So I 100% agree with Susie.
Some topics might seem more naturally to lend themselves to a full body learning experience, but it seems like there are some topics that it might be hard to do. I'm thinking of something like mathematics, maybe literature. Are those going to need to be taught with books or screens? Or do you see ways to liberate the learning experience for any subject?
Well, I think you have to look at the different ages. And my essay is not an attempt to answer all of the questions about what's the best way to educate children, right? That is a subject of ongoing debate and discussion. Just one example that I can give, though, is that there's actually a difference between reading a book and reading a screen. That reading a screen, I might get this wrong, but I think I'm going to try to get it right, that reading a screen activates the parasympathetic nervous system. So it actually, the diodes from the screen get your fight or flight movement reaction, that you don't relax in the same way when you read a screen as you do when you read paper and a physical artifact. Your sympathetic nervous system is engaged when you're reading a book. So actually reading a book can be more relaxing. And common sense agrees with that. People don't sit down, well, you know, some certainly do, but people are not reading huge books on screens, that people still prefer to read paper books, especially for hard subjects, for philosophy, for social science. I mean, clearly people can find short articles on the internet that are fine, but for sustained concentration, you really can't beat paper. So, you know, we should have that conversation. I certainly believe for the higher grades that education can be more abstract, that you don't need to be following leaves for very far in your education, but I certainly think that for the early grades, a high-tech education is just a huge mistake.
We're getting a little short on time. I want to make sure we can get to Erin in Green Bay. Hi, Erin.
Hi.
Go ahead.
So I teach at a high school level, and I have found that, you know, we have this big push of, like, technology, 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 and you get to about lunchtime and some of the students get burned out on technology. They don't want to look at their Chromebook anymore. They don't want to look at the iPads anymore. And I found that I don't get rid of technology completely in my classroom, but the classrooms that have the best, like, inter-student dialogue and the best community of learners are where we actually, like, we take a time out from technology. We have conversations with each other. We go, you know, talk to the early childhood kids if we're learning about child development and things like that. So I agree that we need all five senses, but I think we need to do it in a way where we realize that kids don't want to look at screens all day.
And Erin, yeah, thanks for that call. And Nicholas, before we run out of time, I do want to touch on the point that technology costs money, obviously, but also it can cost money to make sure that those students have that full body experience, whether it's getting them out of the classroom or having, you know, enough staff to be able to kind of facilitate that. Do you see this as maybe having some economic disparities?
Well, I mean, I think the equity argument can cut both ways. I'm based in New York, and the state education department tweeted that technology in the classroom was an equity issue, that we have to make sure that all children get technology. And I thought, well, you know, let's have a serious conversation about what kind of technology is good for students and which kind of student technology is bad for students. I mean, one of the classic ways to learn about biology is to have a garden. So I wish that more and more schools had gardens. I wish that schools had field trips, that kids could go out and see where chickens lay eggs and where beef comes from and what it means to milk a cow. And so rather than just keep putting more and more money into technology, into Wi-Fi, into broadband, into personal computers, I would love to see some of that money redirected and say, how can we get children the full body experiences that wealthy, educated parents take for granted?
And we'll leave it there. Nicholas Tampio is a professor of political science at Fordham University. His recent essay for Eon Magazine is called Look Up From Your Screens. Right now, if you see someone wearing a high-tech wristband, it's safe to assume that they're tracking steps, heart rate, and maybe other health info like how they sleep.
But in the future, those gadgets might actually be sending information to a drone to tell it to bring you a cup of coffee.
IBM just patented a drone that would get information from those personal fitness devices about whether you need a caffeine boost. The drone would collect info on your blood pressure, pupil dilation, and maybe even facial expressions. I'm guessing that might include yawns.
And then, like magic, the drone would swoop down and deliver the coffee to you. No word on whether it would be able to handle your preference for, say, a half-calf skim latte light on the foam.
So, JC, are you for this?
Yeah, I'm quite for this. I would love just kind of coffee on demand that I could just have it delivered to me.
Well, and you know, there are always concerns with things like this about privacy and things, but you know, I'm guessing that people could just look at us and know we need coffee. The drone would just confirm.
Sure.
It.
I also worry about someone just plucking it from the air when it's on the way to me.
Yeah. Well, we'll see if this goes anywhere, but you know, it's an interesting concept. Yeah. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.